Don't you know? Talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, May 22nd, 2014, and the lead headline of today is about the U.S. Freedom Act, which basically, Bill, it declares that the NSA will never, ever spy in the U.S. again, doesn't it? No?
The exact opposite.
Let me give you a little context. The objective of the Freedom Act, which was written by a Republican and a Democrat senator and representative, was to restrain the NSA, pull back their authorities, and essentially make them comply with the Fourth Amendment to one degree or another. Now, the Fourth Amendment's already a law, but the NSA has been ignoring it all along. And the requirements in the Fourth Amendment have been ignored in all the judicial cases that have been proposed. So they put together this bill, and they said, well, here's the things that we think violate the Fourth Amendment, and therefore should be eliminated. So they wrote out the bill, and they had like 150 sponsors for the bill, and it looked like at least a step in the right direction. And then, they totally aborted the act. The NSA basically took the Freedom Act and rewrote it, not just to eliminate the restrictions on them, but to expand their powers. Exactly. I mean, I call it an abortion, it really is. I mean, the child of the Freedom Act is absolutely the opposite of freedom. It is the panopticon. Written by the NSA and supported by all the intelligence and security fanatics in the House and Senate. It's a total.
I have to admit, you did surprise me a little bit there when you said it added powers that they never had before. To the best of my knowledge, they had complete powers. So what have they added that they didn't have?
Oh, well, under the law, it wasn't clear that they could track cell phones, for one thing. Now, under this revised thing, they can track all the cell phone information they want to, including location.
So you're saying it was actually gray area before, and now the gray area is black and white.
Right. And now they're authorized to do that. Now, instead of getting a warrant from the FISA court, they don't have to do that anymore. They can do whatever they want for 7 days and can, you know, retain all of that information they've collected from whatever the source is, for 7 days without even talking to the FISA court. Now, there's a dozen other specific instances. For example, the primary authorization for a lot of what the NSA is doing is in the Patriot Act. So what does the bill do? Does it modify the Patriot Act? No, it extends it for another 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was supposed to expire, but it's not going to expire until 2017.
So essentially, then, what this bill does is it takes a court, which was basically a hand-picked kangaroo court,
secret
in which, in which it never lost except for one time, and said, we're actually going to be better off protecting our liberty if we don't have it.
Right. Yeah.
And replace it with no court at all.
I mean, total inverse opposite of the Fourth Amendment, which requires a judicial determination as to whether or not there is probable cause to believe that a person is involved in a crime. Mm-hmm. That is thrown out the window. I mean, this could be called the Fourth Amendment Repeal Act.
Sounds like it'd be a more accurate title, that's for sure. I guess the question that comes into my mind then is, who the heck sponsored it and who the heck supported it?
Well, there were a lot of civil liberties type Republicans and Democrats who wrote the Freedom Act. But what happened was, both parties agreed that something had to be done for the coming campaign season. So they created the illusion that something was being done by totally gutting this Freedom Act bill and passing it as though it has something to do with freedom. It's to create the illusion that they're doing something to protect people's privacy. Mm-hmm. They did nothing. Absolutely nothing. The way the bill was rewritten, basically by the NSA, it resulted in half of the sponsors opposing the bill because it wasn't what they originally wrote.
Well, there's some hope in there. That means that there are some people, presumably on both sides of the aisle, who actually have some sense and are capable of reading a bill even though they don't require the reading of bills anymore.
Well, here's the illusion that they want to sell during the coming campaign season. The illusion is that bulk data collection has been eliminated. Now, that, you know, was kind of the random cry that the NSA was collecting everything. They were pulling everything and putting it on their own servers and doing whatever they damn well pleased. Well, the illusion here is accomplished by requiring all of the telecom and internet service providers to retain all of the data and give NSA complete authority to access any of it anytime they wanted to. In other words, the information is no longer going to reside on the NSA computers. It's going to reside on private computers that are required to maintain this data for 18 months and comply with any NSA order to search it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over and above that, here's another interesting little thing the NSA put in. The telecoms, including internet service providers and so on, like Google and Facebook and so on, said at least give us the power to report to our users how many data files were being sent to the NSA or the FBI or whatever it was. And so that was included in the original bill. NSA just totally wiped that out. Not only did they wipe it out, but they eliminated the capability of any of these telecom companies from publicizing any of the information they had for at least 6 months, or in some cases, 2 years. So prior to this bill, the NSA had said, okay, service providers, you know, if you want to round it off to the nearest 10,000 records, you can report, you know, how many records you've submitted for law enforcement purposes. That's out the window. If this bill passes, no longer are they able to report it. No longer are they able to give any information about what the NSA has done to glom onto American communications.
Okay, now you've been saying that it's the NSA that rewrote the bill. But what role has the Obama administration played in it? Because obviously the NSA, in theory, reports to President Obama.
Right. Yeah, it's the NSA wants what it wants, which is everything all the time. And so they go to Eric Holder, and they say, we want everything all the time. And so we've rewritten this bill, and here's the provisions we like. Eric Holder says, yeah, sure, if that's what you want, no problem. And he passes it along to Obama, and Obama says, yeah, sure, if that's what they want, that's fine. If it at least gives us the illusion that we fixed all of these Snowden problems by no longer collecting bulk data, politically, if it flies, if people buy the idea that the NSA has been somehow restrained, go for it. And they did.
So what exactly gives the lie to it? Let's pin it down exactly.
Well, there are, of course, like any omnibus bill, there are hundreds of different variations, but it all comes down to one word. And that word is whether or not the government can collect information that complies with the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment says you have to specify the person or the entity to be searched in a court of law and prove that there is probable cause to believe that that person is engaged in a crime. So what they did was they put in a term that said a specific selection term to comply with the Fourth Amendment into the bill. Well, the NSA just changed that from a specific selection term to a discrete term. And this is where this stupid phrase comes in. Instead of probable cause, the requirement is reasonable, articulable suspicion. Articulable just means you can say it. If you can say something and somebody in the FISA court, you know, meeting in secret, thinks, well, yeah, it makes some sense, then you can do anything you want.
Well, it sounds like actually the most important change is the word cause, which has now become suspicion. Because if you have probable cause, that means you actually have to be able to show a connection.
Right, right.
Suspicion, you don't have to show anything.
Right, exactly. They don't like the Fourth Amendment. They don't want the Fourth Amendment. They want an exception to the Fourth Amendment for their purposes. And so that's exactly what they got. They got any definitive term. For example, rather than the NSA getting a FISA court order to collect all Verizon records, domestic and foreign and local, as they did a year ago, that was the first Snowden revelation. Instead, they have to have a discrete term. In other words, they have to say to Verizon, don't send us everything. Send us only the data you have for states in the category from A to Z. Oh, let's make that A to X. Only in those states, A to X. If they start with the letter A to X, then now the fact is that there are no states in the union with letters X, Y, and Z. Mm. So it's exactly the same thing, but they've made a discrete select term that says
the last question that comes to my mind then under what we're talking about here is this going to be challenged at some point, presuming it becomes law, if you can call it law? And if so, let's say it gets to the Supreme Court. What does the court say about this?
I mean, well, we've talked about the different court cases, the Katz, Smith, and Jones cases. And the Supreme Court for decades has deferred to the executive branch and said that's a political question, and the powers of the executive branch to protect the nation override the Fourth Amendment. And as long as they're being reasonable about it, and as long as there's some sense to what they're doing in terms of protecting the country, it's a defense issue and not something the court can look at.
Yeah, but they've actually redefined a key word in the Fourth Amendment, cause, probable cause. They've redefined it as suspicion. I would think so, that's something that goes a little bit beyond national defense. I would think that would be the kind of word that they get excited about. That's the kind of thing that court justices usually get excited about.
Yeah, suspicion is a key word. What they had been using the NSA had been using as a legal interpretation had to do with the word associated. For example, whether or not a person is associated with a terrorist is determined by whether or not they have had any connection or association with anyone that the administration defines as being a terrorist. So, for example, you get somebody that's made a $1,000 contribution to a human welfare group in Yemen. Well, it turns out this human welfare group happens to be affiliated with some element of Al-Qaeda or something like that. So it's a terrorist organization. So that person gets arrested after having his phones tapped and everything else, gets arrested for aiding and abetting and being associated with a terrorist organization. So they've used this, the word associated and the words relevant to an investigation to basically give them free hand, absolute total discretion in terms of what they consider to be associated with or affiliated with.
Okay, granted, they've definitely blurred the line. They've used words deliberately and specifically to make it difficult for the court to draw a clear conclusion. But when I hear that word suspicion, I know that's being used directly as a substitute for cause. That's much more black and white. That's something that, I mean, I'm not saying the court can't ignore it. They very well could. They've certainly ignored a lot of violations of human rights and individual rights in this country. But that would be a pretty blatant one, I would think.
Well, there's another motive involved in passing this supposed Freedom Act, and that is to short-circuit all of the Supreme Court cases that are now pending in federal court and could potentially get the Supreme Court and get a favorable ruling on Fourth Amendment grounds. They basically cut out all of those because they change all of the terms and conditions even though they expand their power instead of limit it, that's going to put a big dent in a whole variety of different lawsuits against the NSA.
Assuming, of course, that the court accepts this language. And now we're back to that same question again. Will they accept the language that replaces the word cause with suspicion? I don't think they're going to do that.
Well,
I mean, I'm not saying they're going to rescue us from the horrors of the NSA. Don't get me wrong. I don't think that the Supreme Court has the kahunas to do anything of any significance. But this is one of those cases where it just kind of, it's like a glaring neon light that flashes in your eyes. And I just can't see how they'll overlook this one.
Well, here's what's happening, and I won't go through the details of the various court cases, but what happened in the case of Katz was that the local police wiretapped a phone booth. And so the Supreme Court said, no, that's an illegal wiretap. You didn't have reasonable suspicion. You didn't have probable cause. It didn't comply with the Fourth Amendment. But one of the members who agreed with the ruling said, well, let's try to figure out why this public phone booth is, you know, supposedly private. How about something like a reasonable expectation of privacy? This person that used the phone booth had a reasonable expectation of privacy in using the public phone booth. It wasn't going to be wiretapped. It wasn't going to be a public conversation that police could monitor. And what happened was that little, you know, subclause in the Katz case became the primary justification for everything, every exception to the Fourth Amendment. That is, you have to have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Well, they said that doesn't exist. If you've given it to a third party, if you've given the information about your phone calls to a telephone company, you've given away your privacy. If you use the Internet, you've given away your privacy to a third party. So this third party rule is what the Supreme Court now is standing on, related to this reasonable expectation of privacy, saying that anything that you surrender to a third party, in particular business records, including bank records and all this kind of stuff, you no longer are protected by the Fourth Amendment. It's no longer a search or a seizure of your information that you own because you gave it to somebody else.
Of course, actually, we don't know that. That's what the lower courts have relied upon. We haven't actually heard from the Supreme Court on this yet. We're hopefully going to. Hopefully, they're actually going to face it head on. They could very easily just kind of skirt around it and avoid it, but hopefully, they're going to address it. But
You know, nobody's going to give up. I mean, the ACLU is probably the leading contender against all of the NSA spying activities. And they aren't going to, you know, they aren't going to roll over. And so it's not going to discourage those who believe in the Fourth Amendment from bringing court cases and pursuing the ones that are already in federal courts. But there is this impediment that the Supreme Court has basically said, if you've surrendered anything, you no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy. If you've given any information to the phone, like right now, I'm on the phone, okay? And I have surrendered all my rights to privacy, not by being on PRN, but because the phone company is a third party, and I'm giving them my voice, I no longer have a Fourth Amendment right to keep it secret.
And I don't think that principle holds it over the long haul. I think the court actually knocks that one down. And there are a lot of obvious exceptions to it. For instance, if you talk to your doctor about a medical condition, he's a third party.
He's
not directly involved. So basically, if we follow that principle through, it means that anything you say to your doctor and anything your doctor says to you is no longer privileged information, similar to an attorney. If you go to an attorney and you're addressing a legal matter with the attorney is a third party. Well, therefore, under this ruling, you have no privacy privilege with an attorney. I just don't see the court upholding that principle. I understand what you're saying, and I understand what the NSA is trying to do about, you know, basically screwing up the language so they can get whatever they want done. But this is the kind of thing where I think the Supreme Court is going to do something. They won't give us a wonderful, across-the-board, broad-brush rejection of the NSA. I'm certain they won't do that. But I think they're going to do something to chop this part down because it's too dangerous for them to keep it in place. There are too many ways that it works against other things that are on their agenda.
Again, unfortunately, for decades, the Supreme Court has deferred to the wisdom of the legislative and executive branches in making.
I don't think they do in this case. I don't think so. Anyway, Eric Holder was busy this week, you know.
Yeah.
Because not only was he gutting the Freedom Act, but he was also attacking the Chinese. I mean, it was a pretty cool week for him. This is the kind of thing that attorneys general really live for. You know, they get to be in the news twice in 1 week, and for things that where they themselves are not in trouble.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all, again, of the same thread of creating an illusion that you're doing something about something that people are concerned about.
Mm-hmm.
So what did he do? He indicted a bunch of Chinese. Said they were government workers, and they were stealing American secrets, and so he filed indictments in federal court. Well, guess what? These Chinese government agents, if they are government agents, or even if they're Chinese, aren't going to show up in the federal court to defend themselves.
No!
So it's totally superfluous. It's just creating the illusion that he's doing something. So the Chinese government said, yeah, sure, well, so what? Yeah, big deal.
Well, actually, at that point, what they said, they denied the charge, and they also countercharged that the U.S. is doing the same thing, and they said that the Snowden revelations make a mockery of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
which amounts to the same thing, I guess.
It's hypocrisy, but they, I mean, what they didn't say was, you know, shove it where the sun don't shine. Because they want to be respectful and diplomatic and all that kind of stuff. But of course, the Snowden revelations included all kinds of information about what the NSA was collecting in terms of commercial enterprises, commercial secrets, business plans, all kinds of stuff. Now, the NSA comes back and says, well, yeah, sure, we're doing that. You know, we've infiltrated a private internet, you know, system in China, and we're collecting information on all kinds of economic transactions through the Chinese Trade Ministry and banks and telecom companies. Yeah, sure. But the only reason we're doing that is just so that our politicians and diplomats, when they're negotiating trade deals, will know what the various companies are planning on doing. We're not going to tell anybody. There's no way that anybody could possibly get, you know, the information that we're getting out of China or Britain or Germany or any place else. We're not doing this for the benefit of the corporations. We're doing it for the benefit of our trade negotiations so that our negotiations can benefit the corporations.
Okay. So there's a fine line here. Is that the idea?
It's a con job. It's just a con job. It's just a total illusion that, you know, we're not doing that, but they're doing that, and, you know, they don't have any right to do that when we can do that, just because we're exceptional.
Yeah, it kind of took away their fire, you know, because they were the ones who were supposed to be doing that. The rest of the world's not allowed to do the same thing. Yeah, it's tough being, you know, it's tough being a bad guy who's dressed up as a good guy. You know?
Yeah, no, it's another of the Snowden documents indicate that the NSA works in strategic cooperation with commercial partners like Cisco, Microsoft, Intel, Oracle, AT&T, Hewlett Packard, IBM, blah, 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 blah. Implying clearly, you know, in their actual documents that they are providing all the information that these companies want about foreign competitors.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this is a strange topic, no matter how you look at it. Let's look at something that, on the surface, appears to be more black and white, because the government crackdown, the FBI crackdown, on a piece of software this past week. The software is called Black Shades, and this is a crackdown that I guess was kind of worldwide, or at least Western Hemisphere. Over 100 people arrested. It was kind of a systematic sweep, and the purpose of this Blackshade software is essentially to invade the computers of people, which it did to the tune of 500,000 to 1 million people, and take over the computer completely. Apparently one of the more visible examples was Miss Teen USA, was a victim of the Blackshade software, and she was actually being extorted by these hackers who were using the software to use her own cam to spy on her when she was naked and so forth. So it sounds on the surface like this is something where the government was actually doing something good for a change. True?
Well, they are. I mean, the Blackshade's tool is called a RAT, Remote Access Tool. The amusing thing is that they have known about RAT, this RAT program, for at least, 12 years, since 2002 is when it first came out. And finally, they had enough, ruckus from people complaining about this RAT program and the fact it was being commercially sold on the open market publicly to anybody that wanted to buy it. They could record keystrokes and steal passwords and so on and so forth. So in 2012, 2 years ago, they arrested one guy who was supposedly a co-creator of this software. This is in 2012.
Okay.
And they threatened him with, 5,000 years in jail or whatever it was. So he agreed to plead guilty and cooperate with the NSA, and so they put him on the payroll, and that was how they got all this information about where the Blackshade software was being distributed from, who had bought it, and he basically did hacking on behalf of the FBI to find out which computers had been using the software to control, remote control, of other people's computers. So, I mean, it's a good thing that they got it, but it took them a long, long, long time to actually get down to filing charges against people. Now, the funny thing was that the authority arrested 100 people as part of a global crackdown because the software was available anywhere. But of those 100 people, there was one in the U.S. So although this is a global cooperative among dozens of different companies or dozens of different countries, as far as the U.S. is concerned, there's only one person in one case beyond this fellow Hoag that they're going to prosecute. There's somebody in Maryland or something. I didn't catch the name.
Prosecute within the United States, you mean?
Yeah.
Because the ones in the other countries are going to be prosecuted in their own countries, no doubt.
Right.
But the question that, and in my mind, and you kind of touched on it there, I think you actually said NSA and meant FBI, but NSA was actually the thought in my mind, because we already know that from previous reports that the NSA has been using virus and malware-type software to extend their ability to spy on the world.
Right.
So it makes me wonder, it took them 12 years to basically expose this ring and start arresting people. Is it possible, is it just remotely possible that the FBI had passed this information to the NSA and the NSA was using this software precisely for that purpose? Precisely
of course
for
they would.
Any of their reasons?
Of course.
So,
it may not have been the Blackshade's version, but I'm sure they took this remote access tool, and it was fairly evident from several of the Snowden documents that they were using a RAT, a remote access tool, to access various people's computers.
It probably means that out of the many Blackshade-type programs they had, Blackshade was probably becoming less and less reliable in terms of tracking anybody because the effectiveness wasn't there like it was before. More and more people were aware of it. More and more people were cracking down on it. So it just wasn't as effective software as it used to be. So they figured, well, this is a great way to throw a sop to the masses. We can show what a great job we're doing cutting down on cybercrime, and all we're really doing is throwing away some software that we don't need anymore.
Well, they're eliminating private competition with the NSA.
Yeah, but there's no such thing as private competition with the NSA, because the NSA does whatever you think. I mean, anybody can make any kind of software like this designed to hack into something else, and the NSA will grab it.
Yeah.
And if you don't play ball with them, then maybe, 12 years down the line, they'll shove you in prison or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you notice that these hundred people worldwide, none of them belong to the NSA, which has been distributing exactly the same or maybe improved malicious software for their own purposes for the past decade. They didn't arrest anybody from the NSA for use of malicious software to infect computers, because the NSA has been doing that all along. Everybody knows that now because of Snowden, but of course nobody's bothered to prosecute them because they are working in the national interest.
So sadly, even news that is black and white still isn't really all that exciting. Well, at that point, let's take a break because I'm getting depressed, okay? After the break, though, let's pick up on some stuff that's really exciting, like monetary issues or, you know, Obamacare or something we can sink our teeth into, okay?
Okay.
This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Walt and Bill, on this Thursday evening. And, Bill, before we go on to monetary policy and all that, I saw a headline here, and I just got to ask you about it. Your headline says, FBI to record itself. What on earth does that mean?
Yeah, well, it was a secret policy change, according to these various news sources, that the FBI, the DEA, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, U.S. Marshals Services, will now be required to electronically record statements made by individuals in their custody. In other words, they are now going to be required, according to the Justice Department, to record all of the interviews that they do, not just with suspects, but with witnesses and that sort of thing, because quietly in the background, they've noticed that they're losing court cases because the claims about what witnesses said or what suspects said couldn't be verified for the courts. And there were cases being thrown out. So quietly, the FBI has decided we had better keep a record of the questions we ask and the answers we get when we do interrogations, so that we don't lose these cases in court. So it's good news in a sense, because at least the courts will be able to allow defendants to get those recordings in their own self-defense, whereas before they couldn't because there weren't any. They intentionally did not record what was going on. It also reminded me of the situation with the torture videos. They took actual videos of the torture that they conducted in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay and so on. And when the court said, turn over the videos, all of a sudden they disappeared. Somebody who had custody of the tapes just simply destroyed them.
So tell me again, where exactly is the advantage here to us? I mean, I can see where the advantage is to the FBI, because any case that they feel benefit their case, they're going to hang on to. Any case that they think are going to hinder their case, they're going to mysteriously lose. Where again is the benefit for us?
No, the benefit is that you now have access to actual recordings of what the FBI said and what the suspect said and what the witnesses said.
At least
a court can get the facts, rather than
they don't lose the recording. But that's the point. If they lose the recording, you don't have access to it.
Well, I suppose they could still lose the whole thing, but the official policy anyway is to record it so that they can substantiate to a court or a jury the facts that they're alleging are true. So that's rather than recording everybody else, I'm fine with the government report recording what their Justice Departments and various divisions do in terms of prosecuting people.
Well, I agree that on the surface it sounds good. I just have a feeling Black Ops is going to get involved in some sort of a shredding process. But, you know,
yeah, they'll probably lose it if they think it's going to hurt them. Even though there's a legal requirement established by the Supreme Court that the prosecution has to disclose any and all mitigating evidence to the defense. I mean, that's been a standing provision of law for a long time. So the fact that they're doing it eliminates the possibility of them saying that they don't have the information.
Okay. Well, let's swing around to monetary policy.
Sure.
We haven't touched on that in a while. Now, we've talked previously about how both Russia and China are trying to move away from the dollar as a reserve currency, and we saw signs of another sign of just that activity going on this past week with a gas deal they signed.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about the petrodollar last week, and this is just another example of China and Russia deciding to get away from the U.S. dollar as the currency of exchange for gas and natural gas and all kinds of different commodities. So this is a $400 billion deal, and it's a gas deal that gives Moscow an economic boost and kind of gives them a little bit of a hammer against the U.S. complaints and European complaints about their provisions of gas, oil, and natural gas.
And, of course, the reason they've been doing this is because of their perception, an accurate one, I would say, that the U.S. has been undermining the dollar in order to prop it up in the face of the financial crisis of 2008 and the aftermath. And yet we now have a report coming out in the last few weeks that the housing situation still isn't improved. And what do we know? This is 2014, so we're now a sixth year away from the 2008 crisis. They've been pumping massive amounts of money into the money supply, all for the purpose of reinflating the housing bubble, and housing's still in a recession. How is that possible?
Not working very well. I mean, the Fed's stimulus program, quantitative easing is what it's called, was dumping $40 billion into purchasing U.S. Treasury bonds. But the other $40 billion was going to Freddie and Fannie Mae, which is the mortgage processing companies that are quasi-governmental, institutions. The whole purpose of dumping that $40 billion a month over the course of 2 years has been solely to prop up the housing market, to prop up the financial institutions that sold all these mortgages to Fannie and Freddie, and to make Fannie and Freddie economically viable so that they can rebuild the housing bubble. Well, after 5 years, it's had absolutely no effect at all. It's lower than it's been since the 2007-2008 crash, and the single-family home construction hasn't been any lower since World War II. So it's one of the economists calls it an unprecedented collapse. What we learned was that if you pump enough leverage into the housing market, i.e. the Fed printing money, and then take it out quickly, you can see collapses like of what you've never seen or never imagined. So that's what's...
But this is almost the opposite. This is pouring so much money into it that it bursts the bubble. I mean, literally, this is kind of like overfilling the tires on the car to the point where they can't hold any air anymore because you just blew a hole in them.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a consequence of the Fed saying, well, yeah, we've been doing this for 2 years, it hasn't worked, so we're going to taper off our investment in the housing market. Instead of $40 billion, we're going to make it $30 billion or $20 billion, somewhere along the way, $10 billion. Well, everybody knows that there's this huge bubble that's out there, and it's not being supported. And so the people who want to invest in new housing construction look at it and say, hey, there's a pile of mortgages, trillions of dollars worth of mortgages sitting in Fannie and Freddie. They're going to become worthless. That means we ain't got no money to buy housing or build housing.
And of course, in the other major impact from all this craziness has been the economy itself floundering, not just the housing market, but the entire economy floundering. Unemployment continues to remain high. Inflation is officially low and has been officially low all along, but we know what kind of a lie that is. I mean, just giving an example, my wife and I made a stop at the store recently because we needed to get some spices. She wanted to make some coleslaw. So she bought 3 bottles of spice. You know what those 3 bottles of spice cost? They cost over $16.
Mm.
$16 for bottles of spices? Are you kidding me? But there's no inflation. Everybody remember that.
Yeah.
And, no, and then on top of that, now we have all this conversation about the minimum wage and the pressure to here in the U.S. to raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour and so forth. And I have to admit, I've been watching that story with, like, you know, eyes crossed or something, because if you look at what the minimum wage today would be, we mentioned this before, but if you look at what the minimum wage today would be if it had stayed in pace with what the official government inflation numbers are, not the real ones, but the official ones, which are understated, if they had stayed in, on pace with those numbers dating back to like the late 60s, early 70s, today the minimum wage would be around $30 an hour. So I watched and read these stories about, you know, the fight to raise the minimum wage to $10 an hour, and on the one side it's oh God, this is going to, you know, create all this unemployment, and on the other side it's oh God, we have to have this because it's the only way that that workers can survive. And I'm thinking to myself, neither of you guys get it. Neither side understands this issue. Well, apparently the Swiss have a slightly different take on it, because the Swiss have a considerably higher minimum wage, and they were very recently presented with the question of should it be increased to $25 an hour, which would put it pretty close to that $30 figure. That's a much more interesting test case to me than whether or not to raise it to $10 an hour. And we got kind of an unusual and surprising response from them.
77%.
And what did they say?
That no. No, we don't.
No increase.
We don't want any minimum wage at all. Now, this is an interesting story, because Switzerland has never had a minimum wage, and so they suddenly wanted to, bump it up and install it at $25 per hour, and they had a plebiscite. And the people voted, and they said 77% of them said, no, we don't want a $25. We don't want any minimum wage at all.
It raises an interesting question. If they ask the same question here in the United States, I wonder what the numbers would be. Because bear in mind that if the minimum wage were on par, after adjusted for inflation, with where it was, say, in the late 1960s, early 1970s, it would be about $30 an hour. So if U.S. citizens were asked about putting the minimum wage at $25 an hour, I wonder what they'd say.
I don't know.
I have a feeling 77% might be understated. I'm serious. I think it would shock the heck out of people to think about a minimum wage that high. And likely because it's so low comparatively to that right now anyway. But I think that would be kind of a wake-up call. And yet, if you think about it rationally, you realize that's where it should have been all along if you believe in a minimum wage.
Yeah, well, there isn't really a good correlation between Switzerland and the U.S.
No.
Basically, because Switzerland is a teeny tiny country, and it's been for decades an elite country, and the actual factual minimum wage in Switzerland is about $35 an hour. That's the least anybody has paid. The average is something like $67 an hour in Switzerland. So it's an exceptional kind of situation. So it isn't surprising that they just said, "Nah, we don't need that."
Maybe we should just move to Switzerland.
There you go. But I don't know the $10.10 minimum wage that Obama has done administratively through federal contractors. It's a good political ploy, because people get the impression it's helping out the little guy. When, of course, the effect of minimum wage is not to help the little guy so much as to help everybody else up the ladder, who get incremental boosts above the minimum wage to keep the ratios all standardized. So it's very much a union program that ensures that the union wages will get increased in proportion to the increase in the minimum wage. So it's a messy political issue, but it's just, it's government trying to control things and trying to, make decisions about what is and isn't a reasonable wage for a particular job. And there is no such thing as a reasonable wage for a particular job, whether it's raking leaves or building a jet engine. There's no standard wage.
I think most workers would agree with you. I think they'd say they're all underpaid, so...
I'm sure every employee considers himself underpaid.
I'm sure, yeah. Well, one more thing on economics before we leave. This is actually more of a political thing, but does have economic implications. The country of India had a major election and a major shift in the division of power in that country, because the Congress Party, which was the party of Gandhi, for the first time in a long, long time, lost virtually almost all their seats. They're left with a tiny handful of seats in Congress, which is, that's quite a significant change for that country.
Yeah, yeah, and it's interesting to me because the BJP party, and I won't try to explain what those initials stand for in Hindu, but they were basically a very, very libertarian party. And the fact that they won an overwhelming majority in the parliament will be an interesting test to see whether or not they actually implement the free market policies that they've been advocating. Extensive privatization of infrastructure, selling off government assets, rollback in environmental regulations, a commitment to, funny thing, in spite of being a libertarianist organization, they espouse Gandhian socialism, which if you look it up, it really isn't socialism. It's more or less private individuals in communities having a little bit more control over the kinds of industries and so on that occur in that particular area. So it's not really socialism per se. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see what comes of it in India.
Well, you surprise me when you say that they are a libertarian party, because that's about the last thing I would have thought of to describe them as. And I don't necessarily consider selling off government enterprises to be an exclusively libertarian thing. In fact, there are certain circumstances under which I think it's something that you want to do in the long run, but not necessarily in the short run. So I'm not sure I totally buy into this, but I'm curious why you think that they're libertarian, because I don't get any sense that they're advocating for individual rights.
Well, no, yeah, it's true. It's characterized as libertarian because most of their policies are economically conservative. So I guess you could call them, conservatives in a sense. But in contrast to the Congress Party, which proposed all kinds of extremely socialist, on the verge of communist programs, and promised all these things to the electorate, the amazing thing is that in a contrast between those two extreme, the extreme position of the Congress Party and the quasi-libertarian, quasi-conservative, economic free market kind of ideas of the BJP party, the BJP won overwhelmingly. So if that's any indication of a social change in political attitudes, it'll be interesting to see what comes of it.
Oh, I see. So now you've moved it from libertarian to quasi-libertarian.
Yeah, well, it was characterized in several news accounts as being a libertarian party. And if you go and look at the Wikipedia description, belief in the free market, privatization, like I talked about, where the government is getting out of the economy, reduction in labor and environmental regulations is a libertarian free market kind of position. But it's certainly not a consistent libertarian position when it comes to other things.
Well, I think that libertarian is probably an inappropriate word. That's my best guess. I can't say I know much about the party. I do look at the title of it. The title is the Bharatiya Janata Party. That's the best I can do on it.
What you said, I agree. Yeah, all the politics over there are necessarily associated in one way or another with Hinduism. There were some racial issues that the BJP party was anti-Muslim and was going to favor the Hindus, and there's an element of nationalism that their national prestige is at stake. And But there's also a significant degree of internationalism. The BJP party wants more open trade negotiations with the United States. So that's a good thing.
It'll be interesting
to see how far.
I'm reading the Wikipedia article as we're talking about this, and I'm reading that, for instance, in 1977, the precursor to the BJP was the Janata Party, and one of the founders of the Jannata Party was a socialist party. Yeah. So I asked myself, how libertarian can they possibly be?
Yeah, if you read through it, I mean, it's definitely gone through an evolution over the past three or four decades, because it started out as just another socialist party competing against the socialist Congress Party. But they've evolved significantly over the course of those decades, and new policies that they're advocating got strong support.
That remains to be seen just how libertarian they are. I'm not about to hold out a lot of hope, but we'll see. Who knows? Maybe they'll surprise me.
We'll see.
Let's see. That pretty much covered what we had there for economics and monetary policy. One quick note. Let's talk about Obamacare. We've got about 6 minutes left. And that'll probably be enough for 6 minutes. But the employer mandate, now we've been talking about that quite a bit over the last few weeks, even months. And there is now speculation that the employer mandate may be dead.
Well, here's the situation. Because the administration took one little clause in the ACA bill, which allows them to make transitionary adjustments, and they've been adjusting things left and right and postponing this and postponing that and so on and so forth. And given that there's an election coming up, and according to the ACA, the employer mandates have to go into effect beginning in October, when they supposedly they were going to open up the exchanges for employer-sponsored medical health programs. And they would comply with all the provisions of Obamacare. But along the way, they said, well, we're not going to enforce these requirements for all companies that have less than 100 employees. We're just going to put that off for a year. So the impact of the big change in October, which is the Obamacare exchanges doing employee insurance programs, is going to affect only the largest corporations that already have them and can afford all the special provisions under ACA and have enough lawyers to figure out what the requirements are. And they're going to do it basically off the exchange in individual negotiations with their insurance companies and their lawyers to determine what they can get away with. So it's not going to be the big election issue come October. Now, the October was supposed to be the implementation date for the enrollment program online. It was supposed to apply to all employers with more than 50 employees or equivalent. And those policies were supposed to be enrolled between October and December and go into effect January 1st, 2015. Well, now you aren't going to see those numbers because it's only going to apply to the biggest employers who are going to do their own negotiations offline.
It's based on a paper that was put out by something called the Urban Institute, and the Urban Institute paper was called "Why Not Just Eliminate the Employer Mandate?" The question that's in my mind is that the Institute paper basically said that the Obamacare provision requiring the employer mandate could be ditched without having any significant effect on insurance coverage. But what it didn't say is what the effect would be on the cost of insurance. And that's the part that strikes me as being the sticking point, because ultimately the only way you can afford, if you can call it that, you can afford to have the kinds of rates that they talk about with their gold, silver, and bronze plans, or and their platinum plan, which nobody can possibly afford. The only way that you can actually afford to have those rates is if the Obamacare law, if you will, gets applied across the board to everybody. Well, if you take all of the employees out of the loop, who are working for employers with less than 100 people or less than 50 or whatever the number is, that's going to remove a significant proportion of the population from the requirements.
Yeah, well,
and
when you do
that, you're basically reducing the pool of money available to cover all these dramatic increases in spending, essentially, that are needed in order to ensure what were previously called the uninsurable, the people who already had pre-existing conditions and so on and so forth. So I just don't see how this actually holds up in terms of the cost of insurance. I can see how it doesn't change the amount of coverage significantly, but I don't see how it protects against the cost of insurance.
Well, here was the problem. When the ACA was passed, they had this mandate in there that says employers shall provide health insurance complying with all of the provisions of the ACA code. And of course the employers looked at it and they said, whoa, this is going to cost a whole lot more money to cover all these different provisions and under these different requirements and financing and so on and so forth. And the CBO actually did an estimate that 15 million employees would lose their workplace coverage from their employer just because of these new requirements. And of course, the last thing the Obama administration and the Democrats want is the kind of fiasco they had 9 months ago when they implemented the individual mandate.
Oh, sure.
So now they want to postpone it till after the election for almost all small businesses and medium-sized businesses, and they don't need to build the exchange, so they can't be criticized for the exchange being a total bollocks. And they're allowing the large corporations to negotiate with their insurance companies and the Justice Department lawyers and health care lawyers to cover themselves.
But of course, this all comes at a cost, though. And that's the point.
Of course.
I mean, essentially, they're taking away the responsibility for paying, quote, their fair share, unquote, on the employees of those small employers. And yet, those numbers, those unfair fair shares, if you will, that they were supposed to pay was counted in when they were calculating what it would take to cover the uninsurables, the people who are, you know, the pre-existing conditions, the people who are going to get the maternity care, and yada yada, all that stuff. That's how they were calculating it. They were depending on that money. They don't get that money anymore. Well, we already know the insurance companies are announcing that there's going to be increases next year. They've already said that, and that's before this thing actually kicks in. What happens when this part kicks in? How much more does it drive the cost up? That's the thing I want to know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't want to get into all the actuarial gobbledygook, but there's all kinds of things that are in these 2,000 pages of the Affordable Care Act. Some of the things that people aren't aware of is that the insurance companies are guaranteed a profit, in essence. They are required to conform with insurance channels. In other words, they can't give customers a range of selection from 1 to Z, you know, A to Z. They have to give them A, B, or C. And therefore, they've got to totally rearrange their pricing structure so that the A's, the really, you know, expensive insurance programs, no longer are carrying the full burden of the B through Z. They all go into the B and C. So the B's and C's, which is probably 90% of the people, would have insurance rate increases. And everybody knew that.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it there because we're out of time. But let's carry on this subject next week because I think this is going to be an important one, okay?
Okay.
Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Sure.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know how talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper while they're standing in the welfare lines?